Good afternoon. So I'm Alan Dunn, and today I'm going to talk about my work, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Machine, Protecting Privacy with Ephemeral Channels. This is joint work with a number of colleagues at UT Austin. So there are a number of applications you'd want to be able to run on your system such that you don't end up leaving traces behind afterward. Let me give you a few examples. So first, I want to have a private conversation with my lawyer over VoIP. I don't want snippets of that conversation to remain on my machine later. Let's say I'm a biomedical researcher and I'm using sensitive data in a computation. I don't want patients' conditions to be leaked by my machine later. And finally, if I'm visiting websites that I don't want people to know I've been to, well, I don't want my machine to give evidence of that at a later point. The thing is, the current state of the art for this is private browsing, which really only addresses one of these use cases, the third. So private browsing is this popular feature in modern web browsers. And the way in which it works is that it's supposed to be you start private browsing mode, then you go to a number of different websites, and when you're done, you shut down this private browsing mode, and all traces of the sites you've been to are erased from your machine. But the problem is that this private browsing property is as of yet unachieved. And in particular, you know, when you go to different websites, evidence of these sites leaks into your operating system. The problem is there's just no system support right now that can actually remove traces from your machine of what you've done. As I interact with applications, and you know, they get data from me and from the rest of my system, this data leaks into the operating system and shared system services like your X server. And applications are just not empowered to remove these traces. So let's give you an example of what happens. So I'm going to browse a website. And so as I do so, data comes in from the network. And so here's what the website looks like. So I'm currently browsing in incognito mode because I don't want people to know what I'm doing. This is a protest website, so it's sensitive. You can see some static images, some text, and there's a sound plugin playing a broadcast of what's going on in our movement. So what happens? The sound plugin is playing some audio, and what will be more relevant in a minute you'll see, let's say the sound plugin crashes briefly. Well, I can still look at the rest of the pictures and text that's on the page, and when I'm done, I shut down my browser. So the question is now, well, what traces still remain on my machine of what I've just done? So we set out to perform some experiments to find out. So firstly, if I'm running a standard sort of Linux system, what I'll find in the X server and in graphics drivers that I run, there'll be pieces of the images from my applications as I close them. So for example, you know, if I have a browser, the last thing that's on the screen is what you'll find. And the reason for the X server doing this, for example, is it makes it easier to rearrange window ordering. So let's look at other applications, like if I have my Pulse Audio server running, what you'll find in Pulse Audio buffers due to this plugin crash is that there'll be a number of seconds of audio data still remaining in buffers. And actually, what you see there in the box is a direct grab from a Pulse Audio buffer. It looks pretty much like the exact file below it. There's only these little bit of interspersed data, which is metadata Pulse Audio puts in there, but it sounds pretty much to the human ear identical. And then finally, you'll actually just find coming through memory complete network packets all the way down to link level headers. So it turns out there's actually quite a lot of data still left on my machine after I'm done with a private browsing session. So you might have heard of something called security allocation, whose goal is to remove data from buffers after they're freed by zeroing it. And this comes through both research, there's a Shredding Your Garbage paper from 2005 which talks about it, and you can actually get the PAX patch which will implement this for your current kernel. But the problem is that, well, sometimes the buffers just aren't deallocated. Like in the cases of the X server and in Pulse Audio, these buffers are actually still around. So even with security allocation in place, you're just not safe. We want to give you the ability to resist a strong adversary who comes along after you've shut down your application, so a non-concurrent adversary, and ensure this adversary can't get details of what you've done in a private application. And we call this property forensic deniability. And we want forensic deniability to be apply for a number of potentially very extreme attackers. So, for example, one that's capable of compromising your system at root level, or one that's capable of actually seizing control of your system entirely, physically. So this leads us to have a few goals in mind. First, privacy in terms of this forensic deniability property. But additionally, we want to make this privacy usable. Otherwise, people just won't use the system to begin with. So for us, this entails, one, being able to run a number of private and non-private applications simultaneously. So I might have a desktop with different windows, private or non-private. Two, that you should be able to support a wide variety of private applications, not just, say, a web browser. And this has some ramifications for our design that I'll talk about a bit more in a minute. Three, we want this to be pay-as-you-go, so that means that you should only pay for private applications. Non-private applications should run basically as they did before. And four, we want the system to impose low overhead overall. So even for those private applications, you shouldn't pay too much. So we designed a system we called Lacuna to achieve these security and privacy, privacy and usability goals. And Lacuna is a set of modifications to a host operating system, Linux, and to a virtual machine monitor, Kemu KVM. And in particular, we did not actually have to modify applications in any way to make use of our system. So now that I've talked about the motivation for this project, I'll talk about the design of Lacuna in more detail, and then I'll talk about how we evaluate that Lacuna meets its privacy and usability goals. So the first part of the design of Lacuna is to create what we'll call an erasable program container for a program. And what this entails is I start with a program, and I want to be able to erase the data and code for this program. So the way in which this works, first I have to think about what my program could be doing on my system. And today's programs are often actually multi-process. So modern web browser, for example, would be multi-process. But these are using IPC to communicate. So if you actually then take a program and, say, put it in a virtual machine, this IPC will actually be contained. So this is what we have done to contain IPC. But that's not really enough to ensure the kinds of forensic deniability properties that we want, right? So the problem is that programs still need to be able to communicate with peripherals. So if I have a program that wants to draw itself, well, that drawing still needs to get to the graphics card somehow. So let's see how that would work, even if I had a program in a VM. Well, right now the program would draw itself, and this drawing would be combined with every other thing in the VM into an image, which is the display of the VM. That's now sensitive, since it contains an image of the program. And that's sent to the emulated graphics card for the VM. At that point, it would be sent to the X server, because the point is that a number of other applications could be running on my system at the same time, and I want to accommodate these. Then, this graphics data is combined and sent to the graphics driver. But the thing is, at this point, you should note that, well, my graphics driver has basically arbitrary dependence on the rest of my operating system. And so the graphics data eventually gets to the graphics card. At that point, we erase the VM. And then you might wonder, well, where's my sensitive data at this point? Well, the entire operating system and the X server has the potential to contain my sensitive data at this point. And so this is the kind of problem that we want to fix. And it's not just a problem for your graphics card, it's a problem for all sorts of peripherals, and to support a wide variety of applications, we want to be able to use all of these types of peripherals. So storage, networking, audio, and USB peripherals. So to break this problem down a bit more, we'll first consider storage devices. So one thing that's interesting about storage for our case is that while data has to be sensitive at the virtual machine monitor, it doesn't actually have to be sensitive once it gets to the storage device itself. Storage just cares that you have some sequence of bytes, not what it is. So what we can do is we can encrypt data before it actually passes through the host OS. And this applies to a variety of things that we use storage for. We use storage for VM writes, so when my virtual machine actually writes to storage. But we also use it for swap. If part of one of my VM process is actually swapped out, that data, the memory of the VM could be sensitive, so we need to ensure that it's encrypted if it's on disk. The second class is basically everything other than storage, because for these devices, data is sensitive at the emulated device, like a graphics card, but it's also sensitive when it actually gets out of the system to hardware, because if it, my data is a picture, that picture actually needs to be displayed as a picture when it gets to the graphics card. So now we need to worry about leaving traces in the host operating system. And so for this case, we design an abstraction that we call an ephemeral channel, whose goal is to prevent traces from being left. So with our goal of not leaving traces that are readable later, we can think of a few possible strategies to do this. One is just leaving no trace. Imagine that I were capable of just routing data entirely around my host OS. Well, then I certainly wouldn't be leaving any traces in the host OS. But secondly, I'm going to see if there's a way of making traces unreadable later. So imagine that I send data through my host OS, but then when I actually get rid of my VM, that the data becomes unreadable. Well, that's the second strategy. And these two strategies correspond to the types of ephemeral channel that we'll actually use. So the first type of ephemeral channel is a hardware ephemeral channel. And what this corresponds to is this strategy of leaving no traces. So what happens here is that I actually allow my guest VM to take control of my hardware. And so at this point, I can actually send data directly to the driver of the VM. The second type is an encrypted ephemeral channel. And what this entails is this second strategy of just ensuring traces are not readable later. So how does this work? Well, so we send data into the host OS, but at this point, it actually goes through a small software proxy that we put into drivers for devices. Now, these small proxies are an order of a few hundred lines, and what we have to do with these drivers is ensure that we're not leaving sensitive data behind. So the driver takes care of it. Then, once data comes out of the software proxy, it's encrypted. So it doesn't really matter at this point where it goes within the host OS. We're just leaving these encrypted traces. Then the encrypted data can be decrypted in the VMM before it finally makes it into a driver in the guest OS. Now, we have a bit of cleanup to do for these two cases. We always have to zero out the VM because it can contain sensitive data. But additionally, for the encrypted ephemeral channel case, we also have to erase the channel key. And so what this does is this cryptographically erases any traces that we've left around. It's a fancy way of saying that it just takes some data that's been encrypted and erases the key so the data can't be read later. So we have multiple types of ephemeral channel. And the reason is that these types of ephemeral channel are good for different things. So for some types of devices, we have hardware support for virtualization. So for example, if you have a certain type of NIC and SRIOV network card, this allows a device to actually appear as multiple devices to software. And what this allows us to do is actually assign some of these virtual devices to a guest. And when you use a hardware ephemeral channel in this way, what this means is you get a few advantages, like the fact that you don't have to modify host drivers, and that actually no host code actually sees unencrypted data. But sometimes you don't have that support, and so we support another type of ephemeral channel called encrypted ephemeral channel. And here, an example is your graphics card, because your graphics card does not actually support hardware virtualization. It's not widespread. And an additional benefit for the encrypted ephemeral channel case is that you can actually don't have to modify guest OSs at all. In fact, we were capable of running Windows and Linux as guests. So now let's see some examples of these ephemeral channels in practice. So the graphics channel I just mentioned, again, since we don't have hardware virtualization support, we need to use some form of encryption. And we'll do this by encrypting VM output and decrypting it when it actually gets into GPU memory. So the way in which this works, we take our image, the VM, it's sensitive, makes its way to the emulated graphics card as before, then it's encrypted, and at that point goes through the host OS and driver, and it makes it into GPU memory. At that point, we can actually use CUDA, which is an NVIDIA-provided mechanism that allows us to run code on our GPU, and so then we can decrypt the data in GPU memory and display it on the screen. Another example, this time of a hardware ephemeral channel, is a hardware USB channel. So imagine I have a mouse and keyboard, both USB devices, that are connected through a hub to a port on my computer. So what would happen here is when I want to start using a private application, I, let's say, put my mouse over it and press a key. So what happens is that we switch into using this private application, and this flips a bit in the VMM that actually says now these devices should be routed to my application. And we actually then allow the guest to take control of this USB controller. So this means that both devices have output going directly to the VM. There are a number of other ephemeral channels that we actually implemented for our system, allowing us to support audio and network, but also there was an encrypted version of this USB channel. Now that we've taken care of one of these two classes of devices where data is interpreted at hardware, we have the other class where data is not. And this is storage. So for storage, we have a few things we need to take care of. First, we need to encrypt VM writes to storage. So what we do is we just take those writes, keep them away from our original VM image file, and we put them in a separate diffs file, which we encrypt. But also, we have to ensure that an attacker can't figure out what locations of my VM image file were read, because this would say what I actually read in terms of files or programs. So we clear pages from the buffer cache, but exactly for this VM image file. So this means we don't take a global hit from clearing the entire buffer cache. Additionally, we ensure that memory that's swapped out of our VM is actually encrypted, but we only encrypt pages for this VM process only. And any encryption keys will also, again, have to be erased on VM exit. So these techniques here are all pay-as-you-go, the idea being we only pay a cost for this private process. So now that I've talked about the design of Lacuna, I'll talk about how we evaluate that it meets its goals, again, of privacy and usability. So in terms of privacy, we first perform an experiment to show empirically that Lacuna does not leak private data. We also quantify the code that handles sensitive data. In terms of usability, we have a number of features that we've provided, and Lacuna essentially meets usability goals partially by construction here, but we have some quantitative measures that we also provide. So we have a low switch time actually into a private application, and that the application performance for private applications is near that of just running a program in a VM. And there's more evaluation actually in the paper itself. So the experiment we run to show that Lacuna protects privacy is that we follow the methodologies set out in Schrödinger garbage to actually inject random tokens, but for us, into peripheral I/O paths. And then once a private program is terminated, we scan memory to look for these tokens. And so the way this would work in this situation, for example, I have a keyboard that's connected to my host OS. And so what I end up doing, I just disconnect the keyboard and instead inject random tokens where the keyboard input would have come in. And so the end result of this experiment was that, one, tokens were almost always found with Lacuna, the only exception being that the NVIDIA proprietary closed source driver makes it a bit challenging to find exactly where leaks occur there. And secondly, that tokens were never found with Lacuna in operation. So this means that there are leaks and that Lacuna actually can plug them. We also show that little code actually handles sensitive data. Remember that for these encrypted ephemeral channels, we actually have perhaps a few hundred lines of code in the, that before we get to these little software proxies. So this actually shows exactly how many lines of code that there are. And in general, these lines of code correspond to data that's outside of Kemu, the reason being that we actually just erase the entire Kemu memory, so there's nothing that code in Kemu can really do. The time to switch into private applications we measured to be fairly low. And in general, it's on the order of a few seconds, which is about as low as any system that allows you to switch between private and non-private environments. And in particular, one thing I'll note is look at the encrypted ephemeral channel times. One thing we found is that a significant portion of this is due to this USB driver disconnect. So when you actually stop using the host driver and then start using a driver that instead works for Kemu. And what we found is that actually, originally there were several toggles back and forth between using the host driver and using Kemu's driver. This is due to an interaction between the guest and host. So we were actually able to remove this interaction, which lowers the switch time significantly to what it is seen here, with no loss of compatibility. And then finally, you know, overall, the impact on full system workloads is low. We ran a number of different benchmarks. So we ran mPlayer, in which we watch video across a network. We ran Firefox, in which we browse the top 20 Alexa websites. And we ran LibreOffice, in which we created a 3,000-character, 32-image document. And overall, what we found is that there was no execution slowdown, and the main effect was higher CPU utilization. The reason being, we're doing a whole lot of extra encryption here, and this is what causes that CPU utilization. So the main place where this was a problem is in the browser benchmark, and maximally we had an additional 20 percentage points of CPU utilization. I'll say that we benefited here significantly from hardware AES support. This is why the system is capable of running with reasonably good performance. And so in conclusion, the things I want you to take away from this are firstly that modern computer systems leak secrets, and that secondly, Lacuna provides this forensic deniability property whose goal is to be able to remove these secrets after your program terminates. The main abstraction that we use to provide forensic deniability is these ephemeral channels that provide private peripheral I/O, and that finally, Lacuna is capable of running full system workloads efficiently.
Hi, Hi, Fitz Nolan, Yale University. I think this is really interesting, and I was excited when you said forensic deniability because I thought maybe there would be no trace at all that I was doing anything that I didn't want other people to know about. But you are leaving, in the case of storage, encrypted data on the drive, right? So I can't decrypt that, but I'm thinking of a court case recently where the judge forces the plaintiff or whatever to decrypt her hard drive. And so is it still, I'm wondering if you think there is still a problem there when my drive is full of encrypted contents, and it is, you know, is there any way that we could address that maybe, or is the only way just to, you know, zero out the whole drive?
Well, so the thing that I would say there is that, you know, what we're not really trying to do here is to actually prevent you from, say, knowing what types of channels were actually used. So in this case, yes, you would be able to see that storage was used because I have, you know, some encrypted blob lying on my desk. But for the exact problem that you mentioned, I mean, one thing is that the key would actually be destroyed for this data, right?
So does the plaintiff get thrown in jail since they can't prove that they can't decrypt it, or is that something that they get away with, you think?
Well, I mean, that seems like a question of the law, really. But, at least the plaintiff would not actually be capable of decrypting that data.
So there's still some indication, though, that you were doing something that you were hiding, right?
Well, there's some indication that you were doing something in which perhaps you wanted privacy. But, I mean, that's not always something that's negative. I mean, for example, if you were actually a biomedical researcher and you just don't want, you know, sensitive patient data to be leaked, that's something actually positive.
Cool. Thanks.
Anirudh Badam, Princeton. I was wondering what you do with the data, the unencrypted data that is on the device buffers, not in the OS buffers, but in the device buffers.
So what we do essentially is that it is quite possible that, you know, devices at perhaps some lower level than we really know are keeping data around. That's not really something that we have visibility into. Our main focus is essentially on the OS. But at the same time, right, you know, through any publicly accessible API, right, we basically do as good a job as we can think of to actually clear out data, right?
Thank you.
Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern. Just to follow along that line just a little bit, it did seem that, in particular, the graphics were cheating a little bit because the same process you use to put data down can perhaps be used to suck it back up again.
Well, for the graphics case in specific, we actually do zero out the memory of the graphics.
Okay, so it's very time. Excellent. Thank you. That addressed that.
Alec Ballman, Microsoft. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more on the difficulty of modifying device drivers for the sort of non-SRIOV case, especially for things like the graphics APIs. How do you deal with the complexity of 3D APIs for modern graphics cards?
Okay, so this is, I mean, this is a good design question in general, right? And I mean, I think it varies a bit depending on the subsystem. But for example, let me give you an example for the USB subsystem first. So one thing we found is that you could actually modify generic parts of the USB subsystem to actually work for most USB peripherals. So sometimes you win, you know, in that case. And when you're talking about graphics here in specific, we don't actually currently support 3D acceleration for VMs. So it's true that, you know, it takes a bit of integration depending on your subsystem.